Spaces.
I don't know, like, so that's why too, like, I've never been involved with like a bunch of like angel investing type things either, because it's really hard to know what is going to be the thing that sort of hits. So a lot of people that do angel investing, they have to be in like dozens of things or like a handful of things, so that like if one of them 100x's or 1000x's, you know, it becomes the next big thing. But predicting what that's going to be and which team's going to do it and which one's going to go viral and all that shit, who the hell knows, really? Like, what's that water brand that went wild lately? It's called Liquid Death or something. It's basically just water. And they branded it with, like, funny little cans. You see that?
Yeah, Liquid Death. But it tastes kind of like aluminum to me. Like, I prefer water out of plastic. I'm sorry. Like, or preferably glass, like a glass bottle of water, no flavor, just pure water flavor. But I feel like when it's in that can for Liquid Death, I can taste the aluminum.
It's a pure marketing play, right? I mean, these are commodity industries where the only thing that sets these things apart is their logo and what kind of lifestyle like they portray. And so people want to identify with, oh, it's funny, it's like a skull thing. That's funny, I'm going to drink this water instead. Like, how silly is that? You know what I mean? But that's the way people work. We're all kind of tribal. We all want to identify with something. We all want to cultivate our persona. And,
or if you're a teen at a party, it looks kind of like a beer can or something.
Yeah, that's
maybe.
They sell it a lot at like festivals and the bars. And like you're sitting around drinking that Liquid Death, you still, people that are drinking will still feel like you're drinking alcohol, so you won't feel like a square.
Yep, I think that's part of it. Or I think that was part of the vibe, at least. I don't know. But here we are talking about it, so whoever it was, it's ingenious as far as like marketing is concerned.
Bottled water and like all that stuff is going to just be like a luxury soon. Like the water, that's one of the, so there's a few environmental things that I don't really agree with. Like, I mean, I want to save the environment, but like, I don't think they're as big of a deal as people say, but I think water is one of those that's going to be a big deal. Like, I think like, you know, when you're buying land and stuff, like this is like tangential, but when you're buying land and stuff, I think it's good to look at like, where is like a drought resistant. And so I've looked in like, for example, in the US, and what do y'all think is the most drought resistant state? I'll tell you after.
Maybe something in the Midwest, like around the Great Lakes, because they're kind of up north too, might get a lot of snowfall.
That there are a couple up there that are in like the top five, but if I'm not mistaken, the number one was Kentucky.
I have no concept of what Kentucky's like, even though I've driven through it.
I lived there for like 6 weeks with my aunt, like during like a summer, like for like a summer visit or whatever, like when I was like 5 or 6.
But... And you were never thirsty while you were there.
It's just like rolling hills of like beautiful green grasses and a bunch of just like little creeks everywhere. And then it has a really big water table. Like everybody has wells out there. So that's cool. And the land there, if you look at the land right now, it's like, I mean, I shouldn't even be leaking this alpha because I want to buy some one day. But yeah, it's pretty cheap, dude. You can get like a lot of land.
The people in this room are going to front run grass.
Y'all need to stay back off
Kentucky. Like 600 acres of what you were going to get.
And it's very remote, though. So, you know, you have to be okay with like very, not all of it, but a lot of it's very remote. Like, you drive out there and, you know, you got to wait and hope that they send you a power line. Like, yeah, like you're drinking a well and, you know, I guess maybe you could do solar or something. But
yeah, you got a lot of county lands in the country you have to dig. Like, they don't have, they may have electric, but they don't have drainage. So you have to, like, dig a septic tank and you got to have, like, all that stuff.
You probably run like your heat off like gas, or maybe you get like a wood stove. I mean, it's like, you know, it's on that level, but you know, beautiful as well. But you know, you don't even want to buy that land in your name probably either. You know, get like a holding company and for tax purposes and for, you know, doxing purposes, you know.
Thing is, in like some of these like rural American areas, though, that have like that are pretty good in resources, there's some serious like, depending on which area, redneck, hillbilly, whatever, you know, there's plenty of people doing like the meth thing. Like they got labs going and shit. You don't know who the fuck you're around. That's the problem. It's like that show. Do you watch the show Ozarks?
I have seen like an episode or two.
That shit is legit, man. That's what those areas are like. It's crazy.
Yeah, I lived in the Ozarks in Arkansas. This is unrelated to the show, but my mom had like, I had like 80 cousins because my mom had like 11 brothers and sisters, and they just had a bunch of farmland out there. And for one whole summer, my parents were like, we don't want to deal with this 7-8-year-old kid anymore. And they just stuck me out there to fend for myself with like 80 of my cousins. And they're all living in like trailers and shit. And then like there were really only two.
No, man, when you have that many kids, that's how that shit goes down. You just pop out and mom's like, here, go survive, man.
Yeah, no, I know. We'd go to like the watering hole and like swim. And then, yeah, there was like no like gas station for like an hour drive, and you're on dirt roads. So if it rains, like, nah, you're stuck. And yeah, we'd like just do stuff for fun. Like we'd get crawdads and make them fight, you know, get like two crawdads and then like see which one was the most dominant crawdad. And they just like rip each other apart, which is kind of cruel, but.
Yeah, it's a poor man's Beyblade, basically.
Yeah, literally. Yeah, exactly what it is. And then we used to go frog gigging, which I didn't like this at all. But like for food, you know, like you got to feed 80 kids, you know. You know, it can get a little expensive. So whenever there was a really big rain and it was like spring, we would go frog gigging. And that basically just means you walk through the gutter or the ditch. And as you're walking through the ditch, like you're just like feeling with your, it's muddy as hell, you know, it's dumping rain, you know, and you just hear everything. The frogs like needy, needy, like everywhere. And you're just grabbing through with your hands and you just feel this big slimy bullfrog. And it was not optional either. Cause I was like, I don't want to do this. Like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to go catch the frogs, but they're like, nah, son, like make you a man, you know, you're going to help feed the family and then they get the frogs. And like kill them and chop their legs off and grill them up, dude. And I was like, I ate one and I was like, dude, I can't do this anymore. But as they're doing it, dude, like, dude, these people are just in the country of Arkansas. And this is a little bit of a graphic story. So plug your ears if you're squeamish, but at this point, I'm just going to tell it. And as they're doing it, like my uncle just has a big like cleaver and he's just chopping them off at like the hip, you know, to get the legs off. Cause you can only eat the legs and you can't really eat like the slimy body. There's not much meat there. And he's just chopping them off and throwing them in a bucket and then just throwing the legs on the grill. And the legs are like still moving and stuff. And the kids are eating it and loving it. Cause like, it tastes a lot like chicken. But, yeah, as I'm eating it, bro, like I'm eating my first one, like I look over and the bucket of these freaking mutilated frogs has dipped over, bro, and they're army crawling like towards it. And my uncle's just like, oh yeah, this happened. So he just throws them back in the bucket and slams the lid on. And I was like, I can't eat any more of these, because like I lived there for a summer, but I was like just from like Georgia, you know, like northern
officially Georgia. Like which area is kind of like officially which area is like hillbilly versus redneck versus, you know, you know how you all these like derogatory terms or whatever, like
that was
Arkansas
totally
crowd. The joke is what do people call those folks?
I think it's probably more hillbilly than redneck. Redneck was more so like Georgia was more so redneck, because okay. Like it's really like hills, like it's Arkansas, like mountains, like the Ozark Mountains, you know. So you're driving up this dirt road up the side of a mountain, and then once you drive up for like an hour, you come to like basically like a clearing, and it's like just the top of a mountain, and that's where like my grandma and grandpa had their farm, you know. They had like chickens, and then, you know, we'd always be eating fresh eggs and stuff, and then they had goats, and you know, you'd eat goat meat like every once in a while whenever it was time, and then other than that they had goat milk and stuff. And then they had two dairy cows for milk. And then, yeah, whenever they got too old, I guess whenever they stopped making milk, kill them and eat them. So, but you know, that's how people do stuff. And, you know, these days people are still eating, they're still eating meat, but they're just so disconnected from that process.
Last time I was in that like general direction. So I went to, from Atlanta, I drove to the Smokies a bit, and up in the Smokies, you know how they have like Gatlinburg and I think Pigeon Forge are the two little towns. They're like little tourist towns. And I was walking around these towns and I was like, holy fuck, this is like hillbilly Disneyland and like redneck studios or something. Like it's like what Orlando is to, you know, Disney World and those type of theme parks. The funniest little parks. Have you been to those towns over there? It's like, it seems like there's not too much in that area. So like all the families bring their, you know, kids and everything to these places. And they're like, you know, you'll have these novelty TV. I mean, I'm sorry. You'll have these novelty, like t-shirt shops and shit with all the funny, you know, like they kind of make fun of like the, you know, like Confederate South kind of idea and kind of have their funny little memorabilia. And they have like all sorts of funny redneck t-shirts and like literally redneck t-shirts. Very funny. And there'll be like a whole bunch of steakhouses and whatever, the whole nine yards, some log cabin looking shit, some water. And then like Pigeon Forge is even more fucked up. It's like the cheapest ass, like theme park looking place you've ever seen with like little water slides and shit.
Yeah, I actually kind of like enjoy it in its trashy nature. Like, I think it's
kind of cool. It's funny in the nature of it, what it is. I just think it's hilarious though.
And there's little like places you can gold mine, like get little rock or a bucket.
Exactly.
So as a European, I have several questions. First of all, what's the difference between a hillbilly and a redneck? Second of all, what is Appalachia? And third of all, why is Appalachia in the States when it sounds like something from Eastern Europe? Thank you.
Rednecks like the Southeast, a hillbilly would be like, they were just kind of on the wrong side of the war, but they're still up north, so they're in the mountain areas. But that's how I would define it. Rednecks like
an Appalachia would be like country. Virginia, like I think, I guess it's West Virginia, and a lot of those areas were named after. I mean, you're talking about basically Brits and stuff that named a lot of that stuff. So Germans, Brits, there's different little immigrant groups.
You follow the whole Appalachian Trail or whatever, that's pretty far down. Like, I was technically living in Appalachia. I used to live in Asheville, North Carolina, which is like Western North Carolina, and that's the Appalachian Mountains too. And then the Blue Ridge.
But Appalachia is like, if the Western mountains of the United States are the Rockies, and then maybe like the smaller little mountain range west of the Rockies is like Sierra Nevada or whatever. The Appalachians are the eastern sort of mountain ridge, which kind of extends quite a long way.
Does it house hillbillies or rednecks?
I think that's more hillbillies we think about out there. Yeah.
Like, I think hillbillies.
It's kind of like
shit like that. Like, you know, whereas the hillbilly, and this is, you know, a very leather armchair topic to discuss, which is pretty fun. But the hillbillies are more like living in the mountains, and they're like higher elevations, and they're not quite as like, yeah, I mean, I guess they're on the wrong side, you know, whatever you want to call it, of the Civil War, you know. It's, I think the Mason-Dixon, where's the Mason-Dixon line, actually? I'm not sure, but either way, hillbillies, I would say, up into North Carolina, you know, that's
the border of Tennessee, like that. That's why Tennessee has that like flat shape. Maybe I'm wrong. I forget now. I'll pull it up. Anyway, yeah. But these are like these I don't know if it's derogatory terms. They're kind of tongue in cheek, sort of like for the different type of, and you're basically talking about a white crowd, essentially, obviously. You're not talking about random other people. It's kind of a white crowd. And then it's like, you know, the thought is like they're kind of like undereducated, living under a rock type of crowd. And like a lot of those kind of like really, really rural areas, some of that's just farming town, good folk, whatever. It's not, you know, nothing special about the crowd. But then there's also like
you know, some of the drug runners who, like, you know, cook meth and shit are hiding in these different mountains and things too.
So you have if you look at somewhere like West Virginia, it's like, it's one of the most impoverished places in the country. I mean, that's why these people are so uneducated. You know, it's like
I went and worked about like a month out in West Virginia over the last year, interestingly. And man, there are a lot of like drug overdoses out there. God damn. It's like every day. And this is at like a modest size hospital that's just nonstop. So there's a lot of drug addiction and all sorts of shenanigans going on out there too.
Like, I would say like a bigger percentage than you would think of their local economy is all drug based. There's just like nothing else there.
Oh yeah. No surprise. Yeah. I mean, just if you just look at the number of patients that we're rolling through, it's like, Jesus, it's got to be pretty big.
It comes with low income areas as well. Right. I saw a documentary on Appalachia just a couple of weeks ago where all those mining towns that shut down because they're not mining coal anymore. Like, there's no income there anymore, but there's still complete towns full of people that need some form of income. So that's where a lot of the drug traffic comes from as well. Plus, there's a lot of people without jobs that don't have anything better to do, and you see drug use going up in those kind of areas as well.
Yeah, so substantial portion of the Midwest is called the Rust Belt because there used to be a lot of car manufacturing type of jobs, and like that's kind of ebbed and flowed over the years and stuff. And that's resulted in substantial areas of like very severe poverty in some areas.
So how does this all apply to Zep though?
Oh, it doesn't. We're just fucking around.
Yeah, I kind of figured.
No, we were in the morning. I was setting up my mining rig for Zep, and Up and I were talking, and we were kind of sorting that out. And then sometimes we talk price action or whatever. Sometimes just shoot the shit. It's just fun.
See, mining, we go full circle, right?
What's that?
Mining. We've gone full circle from mining towns now back to mining crypto. There we go.
Yeah, exactly. This coin, like, I don't know if you're mining it, but it's CPU mined, so you can run it on your just PC. So you go to Zephyr Protocol and just like grab the rig. It's the same protocol as I don't know if you're aware of it, but this is the same protocol as Monero. So it's CPU mined, which really helps in decentralization. It's pretty cool. It's pretty well secured now as far as sort of network hash rate and everything. And I was just running some miners to sort of mine a little bit of the same coin that I purchased just for fun. I guess you are probably enjoying the link action, huh?
I am. Yeah, to be honest, I just dropped in because I saw his faces and I was bored. I'm not familiar with Seth, but you can inform me a bit if you want to. So the mining is cool, but what about the ecosystem itself? Like, what can I do on the blockchain, and what's the main purpose of the blockchain?
So similar to how like Chainlink's primary purpose is truth, basically, like with oracles, real world assets, and all the other things. I would say another part of the ethos of crypto is there's a niche subset that's based on privacy. So privacy historically has been things like Monero, things like Zcash, things like Dash and Secret Network. So there's definitely some, and there's probably some others that, you know, I don't recall and whatever. The market cap of all those put together is probably like $5 billion or something. It's not too high if you put them all together. Most people just only care about crypto if a number go up. We know that, right? Like, they don't really care necessarily about the actual specific utility. Zephyr, what they did was they basically created what's fundamentally like a Monero fork. And Monero has been out since about 2014. It used the RandomX algorithm for hashing. And we know that to be a pretty secure, pretty safe protocol over the years. It's done pretty well. So they took, it's a non-group of devs, by the way, because with privacy, the best thing you could possibly have is the devs disappear. Like, you don't know who they are. But they created a Monero fork, but what they added to it was the DJED protocol, DJED, which is it's the over-collateralized stablecoin into the mix. So there's a ZEF token and there's ZSD, which is the over-collateralized stable dollar. And that's, there's no algorithmic thing. It's not like Luna UST or, you know, some of the other ones. It's basically DJED protocol, which is like you're 400% minimum over collateralized with the mined asset. And because it's a mined asset, you have basically a proof of work, you know, asset with a substantial amount of value to it because it's mined attached to this thing. And then as so long as your minimum 400% collateral ratio on the reserve token portion of this, you can mint the stablecoin. And like right now, for example, the market cap of Zeph is like, you know, 60, 70 million, something like that. And the market cap of the stablecoin is only $1 million. So very, very over collateralized, super capital inefficient. But what it does is it creates a very comfortable sort of like convenience token in the form of the stable dollar coin. So imagine if you had like any other proof of work coin, you had Litecoin, you had Bitcoin, you had Monero, whatever, but you could swap it in your wallet to a stable coin without needing a DEX or a centralized exchange. That can be a convenient feature, you know, just so you can send your friends some stable coin or whatever. It can also be like a trading instrument in that you can swap back and forth. But even like maybe more important is the fact that it's all private. So when you swap from the stable coin to the unstable coin, as it were, and back, you don't actually show in any of those transactions to anybody. And so you can imagine what that implies. But basically, it's pretty useful. So I find this to be a pretty useful system. I just stumbled on it with like Up and some of these gang only in the last couple of weeks, like maybe 2-3 weeks ago. And I have nothing to do with the protocol or anything. I just think it's super useful. Like full disclosure, I bought a bag. I want number to go up. So here I am chatting about it. But I do think that the protocol is something I want to have actually work, because I moved a substantial bag into this, not only because it can go up and has good potential, but because when it does, it's extremely useful to me personally. So that's the reason I'm personally in it. So like one of my biggest bags is like Chainlink, for example, and that has a very different narrative. It's like the truth and, you know, on-chain truth narrative. And this is like on-chain privacy. You cannot do, and there's no stable, I'm sorry, there's no smart contract platform whatsoever on this, by the way. So you don't really do anything except what I described. Basically, you have your number go up coin, and then you have like the over collateralized stable that you can mint.
And one thing you might want to add, Sefi, when you pay something in a stable coin right now, like USDT or USDC, you either have to trust this money to a centralized exchange, so people don't really know what balance you hold, or if you hold it in self-custody, they can always see what's the balance on your wallet, right? You don't have that on ZSD because it's all private. No one can check.
Right, because if I sent you some ZSD, you won't know how much what the balance of my wallet is, and I won't know what the balance of your wallet is, right? Because once you share wallet addresses, you're basically just giving up this information.
Yes.
Also, other things too, like what if a bunch of whales from this particular project were selling? Let's say, you know, what if like maybe some of the project team was selling? One good thing about it being anonymous is that like it's impossible to FUD anybody because all of these are possible, but they're also unverifiable, so you have no idea. So imagine like Bitcoin or, you know, where, you know, Satoshi decides to sell some tokens to buy a cheeseburger, right? The whole world is going to freak out, right? Like we thought Satoshi was dead. The good thing about privacy chains is that because everything's anonymous, the free market can take its role, like without a lot of on-chain metrics. So on-chain truth has some advantages, and on-chain privacy has different advantages. Like both are pretty much necessary, and I think this system is the first one to do a good job, I think, with from the get-go, because of what the lessons of like Haven protocol and the lesson that we're, you know, they got wrecked, and the lessons of like under collateralized systems, the Luna UST type system where basically you had a proof of stake system that ran this thing. All these things broke for different reasons, including like having centralized actors like Doquan or whatever, like. So you wind up with team risks, you wind up with founder risks, you wind up with all sorts of issues. So I think like this particular one, as someone that's been around this space for a bit, this one speaks to me on some deeper level, is all I have to say. And so like, you know, so this is among my sort of conviction coins besides like a few others.
Can I be devil's advocate here for a second? Okay.
Shoot. Yeah.
So I hear what you're saying. I see the novelty and the utility. But I do think that utility is limited. So what I mean by that is these advantages that this stablecoin has in terms of reliability and privacy, I'm just not convinced that those would weigh against the ability to have another stablecoin like USDC or USDT with all the flaws that you've mentioned. But then again, with all the utility that it has, because you can use it on any chain and it's easy to get, and there's always a lot of liquidity for it as well.
Fungibility is important. You hit the nail on the head. I don't think this is going to be like replacing any of that shit for sure. Because the reason it can't is because it has to be so over collateralized to prevent like death spiral effects of depegging events, because the stable coins just arbed on the open market. There's no actual mechanism within the system to repeg it. So you're right. Like, it's not going to be something at scale. It's I think of this as Monero, which basically has a 3 billion market cap with a splash of stablecoin. That's all I would consider it. Like, if nothing else, if the stablecoin does not even get popular, it's just a convenience feature. I'm good with that, man. Like, I don't even care if it gets adopted. In fact, I don't mind if it doesn't, because then like we don't have to worry about any kind of like chain reaction events that might affect it. But because the core coin is proof of work, the market cap right now is about 70 million. Monero is about 3 billion. The hash rate on this network since June, it only opened in June, is about 2 to 2.5 gigahash per second. Monero has been around since 2014, and its hash rate's 2.5 gigahash per second. So that's kind of where we are in the kind of like the growth cycle of this, which to me is compelling. Like, if I was going to buy, if all I want was privacy, I could go get Monero now, right? But if I want a privacy coin that's relatively fresh, that's the probable number go up, then this is a kind of a neat little spot to be in.
Well, but the number go up based on Monero has a 3 billion market cap. That's also something I want to touch on, because we see more of these dino coins like Monero, but also things like XRP that have been around for a long time and have a substantial market cap. Like, I think XRP is still like number 4 at the moment, while essentially XRP has no utility and no intrinsic value as far as I'm concerned. Like, there might be people in the crowd that disagree. So I think it's a dangerous logic to go like, oh, well, it's a 70 million now, but Monero is 3 billion. So
the liquidity dynamics, I want to say something. That's okay. The liquidity dynamics are something that we haven't had before. And the stable coin, you know, it offers you trading in the app, but it also offers you liquidity. You know, each of those coins that are out there in existence are, you know, you have the ability to trade back and forth in the app. And so, whereas the current coins, you know, if you want to trade or take profit, then you have to take some liquidity off of the centralized order books. Here, it's not necessary, nor is it even incentivized for you to take that liquidity off the centralized order books. You might as well take that liquidity off the protocol itself. And, you know, I think that ZSD serves as a way to minimize sell pressure liquidity on the exchange. And so you fiat on ramp, and that's that demand coming in. But then as far as, you know, unless you want to completely exit the coin forever, there's really no need to sell, whereas it used to be the case, and you know, it is the case for Monero, for example, that if you think that it's a little bit overbought and you want to take some profit, you have to sell that on the centralized exchange, and that takes out a lot of that bid side liquidity. You know, that removes bid side liquidity inherently, and so now we don't need to inherently remove bid side liquidity in order to take profit briefly, or to try to, you know, hedge against a big pump or something like that. So you can see how there's
keeps liquidity within the wallets as opposed to like heading off to exchanges or to Tether, whatever, to some extent.
Yeah, and you know, the amount of ZSD that's in existence is, I guess, the full extent that it could do that. But you know, I think that is something that, especially as the market cap gets bigger, you know, there's $1 million ZSD now, which, you know, that's a lot, but not, you know, crazy amount. But as it keeps growing and we keep, you know, minting and keeping that, you know, collateralization level high, you know, it just is a low risk way to remove some of the need for built-in exit liquidity you know, short-term exit liquidity. And so I think that there's a lot of utility there that people haven't really realized, you know, how powerful that can be, especially like in a bear market, when books can get a bit thin. You know, it can help support the protocol. And then, you know, on top of that, the ZSR ability to incentivize fiat on-ramping during periods of large drawdown, you know, I guess the math is something around 75% drawdown, you know, some of these coins, you know, they might go up 100x and then they might go back down 99% at the end of this bear market. But having that built-in mechanism to kind of cushion that, you know, there's a really big difference between 75% drawdown and 99.9% drawdown. There's really is a massive difference where one is still a bag and one really just isn't even a bag anymore. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of mechanisms here that people aren't really keyed into yet. And it's very easy to dismiss this and say it's XRP, but what does XRP do? Nothing. You know, what does this do? Well, it has some liquidity mechanics and it has a core privacy narrative. And I think that
I would agree, by the way, that XRP is fundamentally pointless.
I wasn't comparing the function of the system or the token with XRP. I was just making the point. Exactly. Yeah. Hey guys, thank you very much. I love the conversation. I'm going to look into more because it's interesting, but I have to drop out as well. So
yeah,
thanks and have a good night.
Yep. Hopefully your link back.
Cheers.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I tend to have like, I'll buy any asset if it's interesting. I don't get too tribal about it. You know, there's interesting projects happening all over the place. I don't worry about it too much. I'm kind of like, I think just software in general, in a sense, will have a tendency to be improved upon and cooler shit gets made. And, you know, like if you ever played video games, how many people say, oh, I'm only going to play Pac-Man forever? Nobody says this. Like, you know, like people come up with new shit all the time. Some of them are fun. Some of them are boring, whatever. Like, it's all, to me, all this like money is just one big video game, honestly.
Oh no, it is. Trading is 100% like a video game, and it's a fun little game to play, and it can be very lucrative, or it can destroy your life if you're not good at it. So, but one thing that I will say is that I think that the core point of basically every coin is number go up, right? Like that's like the core utility, and then there's all this other utility that goes on top of that. But when it really gets down to it, you know, there's people that want to hide from all this M2 money supply, and that's a lot of the core utility. So then you look at that. I mean, will number go up on XRP? You know what? Honestly, over the course of the next like 2 years, probably. But how much? Who knows? And why? Really, who knows? And what's it really tied to? No idea. So that's not really something I want to get into. I like something that has a favorable conditions and favorable liquidity dynamics to give it a little bit better of a shot, and then
a little bit of a flywheel, like we were saying, something to kind of keep people in the ecosystem and continue to use it, and that reduces the sell pressure just a little bit compared to every other thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I just want something that kind of makes sense for it to, you know, keep going up a little bit more than others.
Yeah, and I think, like, there's definitely you know, and also just product market fit. You say to yourself, okay, you make this gigantic Venn diagram of all the different people who want crypto for different reasons. And here you have this Venn diagram where it's like, okay, you've got the stablecoin piece, which is minor. You have the privacy part, you have the proof of work part. So you already hit on three different things. You have all the other things that crypto normally gives you, self-custody, et cetera. But I think the fact that you can trade between the stable and the unstable in your wallet if you wanted to, that's a fourth piece, because that sort of serves as a quasi DEX function, not exactly, but sort of, right? So like that's another little element of it. And then, you know, beyond that, if like there are ways to sort of like accept payments in a simple way, that, you know, that's going to be something that someone's producing. You know, you have like a few flywheels going on, and at least enough narratives, because like a lot of this stuff pumps on narratives, not necessarily because you can buy coffee with the stuff. So right, as long as there's like good reasons to hold it, because this, at least I have a reason to actually hold it, right? Like I actually took gains from other shit and dropped it in this, right? Like how many things do I do that with? Not very many, right? Like where I'm like, I'm going to move it to this, but I'm going to hold it in this.
Because the market cap's so low right now, like especially compared to hash rate.
Oh, yeah. A nice secure network with a low market cap, probable number to go. Like, if I had to guess, like, what is the guess here that the number here goes from $27 to $1 versus $27 to $1,000? I will bet you that the probability is higher of going to the 1,000 before it gets to one. You know, like, I think it's more likely. That's just my take on it. But.
No, I feel the same way. Like, it seems like the supply is kind of stabilizing already. And, you know, the mechanism's there and the narrative's there. And there's really just not that much competition in the privacy space, not this level of competition, at least. And so you just have to believe that that sector as a whole is something that's going to be here. And then I think that naturally the liquidity will flock to it just because of the lack of competition. You know, if somebody says, well, you know, I think the future of crypto definitely involves privacy. It doesn't just involve public blockchains. And I think that's something that a lot of people will be saying, and it's pretty easy to, you know, to think that. And I think that's a very solid bet that that's the case, because I don't think that all of crypto is just going to be public blockchains. Then you have to look at, you know, well, what's the real market cap of competition? And, you know, right now it's really just Monero and this and Zcash are the primary, you know, privacy coins that I can think of. And maybe a couple others. I'm sure there's a couple others that I'm forgetting right now. I guess there's like Haven.
Like, so the Haven, I was just looking at the chart just now to see what happened with it. So, it had a gigantic pump at some point in its history. Let me see. That was okay. So it peaked out like with the 2021 pump at the outlandish, like $28 or some shit, like some ridiculous number. Let's see what it was. Yeah, $28.90. Okay. It's now, like, as of a few months ago, it was sitting at like 11 cents, and now it popped like a 3x to 33 cents. So it's catching a little bit of a bid, but its market cap's about 9 million. And their system had a stable coin that basically fell apart.
Flywheel.
What's that? Go ahead.
Like flywheel to zero, like kind of similar to how Luna did.
Yeah. And the reason for it was because it has a mint burn mechanism and developed sort of a hyperinflationary, you know, part of that. And apparently they fixed it up. Like, they did some new shit to the protocol and whatever. But at the same time, the problem is you have the bag holder effect where, like, you have a, you know, prior resistance. So the problem is, even if they fix it, you're going to have a lot of people that are going to sell their bag as it goes up, right? Because they're tired of holding it. So you always get that effect with previous price action. So to be in a fresh coin like this, I think, to me, is the, like, more interesting play.
Yeah, it's like all these people, like, that's what I was saying earlier about the 99% drawdown. And 99% drawdown is massive. And you just want to get out whenever you just have a little tiny breath of fresh air, just a little bit of liquidity comes in, you're going to want to get out. And all the way up, there's people that are just locked in. Like, you know, what is that? I wonder what those numbers are, like 28 down to freaking, you know, 11 cents. Like, I mean, what is that? Like 99.9, you know, something like that, like 99.5, like the bag got deleted. You know, like, it's like you had 1,000. Well, now you got like a couple bucks, buddy. Like, go buy a latte, you know, like, it's pretty tough. Like, that's tough. And a lot of coins got hit like that. And I mean, you look at what happened to Luna. It's down basically infinitely. Like, there's just infinite sell pressure forever. Like, everybody that had any little squidgy, tiny bit of liquidity already got out, you know? And so having that, that fiat.
Well, remember, Luna and Luna 2 are two different coins. You know that, right?
Right. Luna 2 doesn't have that.
Yeah, Luna, like, yeah, Luna Classic has like an interesting dynamic, and then Luna itself has a weird story. So I think Luna is going to just do, like, it's going to skyrocket too, because it's basically a fully functioning Cosmos smart contract chain now with none of the previous baggage. And it's actually one of the most decentralized chains in the Cosmos, because it was like a phoenix out of the fire. So, like, it was like a big mess of coins. And so when the new validator network came out, it was like became one of the most, among the most, decentralized batch. So it's interesting though, but yeah, it's no longer doing a stablecoin thing. So, like, Luna also doesn't have like a clear, you know, what is its reason for existence type of thing. And I think with Zephyr, like, at least you can tell someone there's like a precise reason for its existence, as opposed to just like, well, like, only number go up, or like only privacy or something.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess the main thing is that it's like really hard to buy something like Haven right now. It's even really hard to buy something like Zcash right now. But you know, Monero makes some sense. You know, I like Monero. But as far as it, you know, is $3 billion, you know, pretty close to where it should be, you know, maybe right now, but you know, maybe in a bull market. But
remember, like, you know what's interesting about the privacy thing is, let's say privacy just takes off for some reason with all the shit going on the next couple of years. Let's say it did, and Monero starts really picking up for some reason. Like, if Monero skyrockets for any reason, like, then Zeph is just going to absolutely moon, right? Like, so you just like the because that same buzz will translate to all the coins and privacy at that point. Usually, right? Like, the narrative itself catches a bid, then everything just flies.
Oh yeah, and there's really not that much stuff that you know, proof of work coin is nice, and one that like hasn't been completely ASIC'd to death is also nice. So there's a lot of good with that too. And you know, decently low market cap. You know, just a lot of reasons to mine it still. And then, you know, when we have that many people mining it, you know, that distribution of the hash rate is better as well. So that's always good. Yeah, in general, I think that I see a lot.
I bought a lot more of the actual coin than anywhere. Like, I bought like way more actual coin than anything that I'm mining. So to me, like, there is zero reason to sell my mined coins, in the sense that, like, why would I go through that trouble just to sell them? I could just simply buy them outright, or I could just like sell them on profit when it goes up. But so I think a lot of people that are individual miners are not going to be like quick sellers. They're not going to be like, oh, I need to pay for this computer next week that I just bought, so I need to like sell the coins in order to like get my reimbursement back. I think a majority of people are going to use computers that they have or like whatever, and are not going to be starting mining farms and shit where they have to pay for the electricity immediately. I think the vast majority of people, like Upset, are going to be spec miners, people that mine because they want to hold the coins. And that creates a hodler effect. And I think that's what Caspa got, man. Like, I mean, look at how much the market cap went up despite like just crazy hash rates on that chain, right? Like, it's not like everyone's just selling. So
right.
There seems to be like kind of a, you know, I think proof of work chains, though, another thing might be that like a lot of miners kind of get tired of a bunch of random small coins coming out. Like, because that is a funny thing. Like, people produce a coin all the time, but then they're probably tired of the ones that don't do anything and don't actually go up. So if you have a couple that do well, like a Caspa or maybe a Zephyr, then like you like, there's a lot of miners who probably will say like, oh, I'll invest in that because I need a proof of work thing that actually does something and goes up like, and just doesn't languish forever.
Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, mining, a lot of the people that are doing this mining, you know, especially right now, setting up the, it's not crazy hard to do if you've got some type of technical background, but if you don't, you know, it's a little bit harder. And I think that the ones that have that technical background, most of the time it's just like, well, I had this extra rig sitting around, you know, whereas like, it's not like, okay, I just learned about this coin, like, okay, I got to go buy this thing and now I got to go set it up, you know, and all this stuff. It's like more like, you know, oh yeah, I got an extra rig, I'll just point it at it, you know. And so it's a much different dynamic.
Yep. Although it's pretty straightforward. I was able to get the two running, you know. Up was able to walk me through like what shit I copy into what box and paste and stuff. And it's a few little parameters that have to do with like, you know, just some details. But I got both of them up and running now, so it's pretty good. Running nice and smooth. In fact, let me see, like, okay, let's see what it estimates as how much Zeph is gonna produce now. So let me refresh this. It's initially, I wasn't like, it didn't create much averages yet because I hadn't had it running long enough. Yeah, this thing claims that I'll be probably at somewhere between 3.4 to 4 Zeph per month. It's not bad. So at current price, that'd be like 110 a month. I mean, bull market dynamics, I think like, Zephyr at minimum, I think, is a 10x. Like, that's just minimum. Like, that just, I just suspect, is a normal. Like, it wouldn't surprise me at all. And that puts us at like, per month, that would put me at like $1,000 a month. right? If it's actually, we actually hit those levels. So we'll see how it goes. But I think that this thing can stabilize at a market cap easily 10x from here. Like, how many different chains am I on? And like, most of them don't do shit compared to this, quite frankly. So I think that the it's not hard to create like a serious fan base for Zephyr, you know, assuming that no clusterfuck happens and whatever, right? I always assume your shit can go to zero, by the way. If I didn't say that today, again, I'll say it again every time so that people don't over allocate. But I think from a mining perspective, if like you're 10x from here, and I've got a couple of rigs running, and that's pulling about $1,000 a month approximately, that's pretty good deal for a couple of computers, right? Not a bad return on investment for just a couple of mining rigs. So I think it's worthy of mining, especially if you have a computer sitting around doing nothing and your electric prices are reasonable. Someone was asking about some issues of the wallets and things. So the web wallet periodically has gone down because really high traffic to the wallet. So they need to bolster the infrastructure a little bit so that the website can handle better traffic, I think. And then the second thing is when you're using the web wallet, sometimes it's taking a while, like, cause it has to kind of like, you know, read the blockchain and reload some information. So you gotta be patient for a little bit. Sometimes once it's running, it takes a minute or so to get the thing resynchronized. Especially if you haven't run the wallet in a while. And then the desktop wallets, when you download them, they're going to show as like malicious software. So you have to counteract that on your, on your Windows Defender or whatever, you know, antivirus system is preventing you from opening things. It's going to come in as like unauthorized, you know, software that doesn't have any certificates and whatever. That's pretty normal for this sort of thing. Cause like, you're not going to take a privacy thing and register it with, I don't know, the internet or whoever. So this is not a thing. So you're always going to have that issue. Dugan is actually waiting for the iOS wallet to get approved on the Apple iPhone App Store. And once that happens, that should be a much more, hopefully, easy experience. Pretty seamless. And with, you know, then you won't have any of these delays and whatever. And like, concerns, because the problem right now is part of the users, like, it, there's a friction process, because if the web wallet doesn't work, people get pissed. If the downloadable wallet, they're not sure if the security is acceptable. At least in an iOS based system, you have wall garden. Most people you know, can run apps on iPhone and stuff quite safely within each of those apps. I think it'll do a lot for growth of the ecosystem to have that. Or I don't know, maybe not a lot, but like enough to reduce some of the friction, and you can tell your friends, oh, by the way, just get the Apple wallet, you know, on the iPhone, because it's going to be the quicker way to, you know, like have a functioning wallet ultimately. Not to mention, a lot of people typically do mobile first anyway, and mobile web wallets are probably are safer actually in many ways than even hard wallets, but, because you can make mistakes with those as well in terms of like smart contract wallet drains and stuff like that. So I typically think that phone related hot wallets are not a bad choice for reasonable security. Anyway, so all that should make it a lot easier.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And having said all that, I don't know for sure that all of the wallets, the desktop wallets, are 100% safe or whatever. I haven't read the code. I don't know. Like if one of those things can get compromised in some way, I have no idea. So before you assume that like it's safe, I don't know for sure. But they do work. I know that. So there's that.
Yeah, it's been working for me. Once I did the permissions and figured it all out. Yeah. I was using the web wallet at first, and then, you know, the web wallet went down, so I had to do the other wallet. And I guess I just don't understand why you wouldn't be able to verify the privacy wallet. to make it okay with Apple, but I guess maybe Apple just wouldn't. It would just violate their terms of service, or I don't even know. But
I think Apple, you can do it. But getting certified with like Microsoft Defender and all those little things, so that you can make sure that like it doesn't show up as like this is a virus, that takes more time.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know what I'm talking about? It's like the web browser security, not so much Apple's. It's not so much Apple's like phone, you know, Apple's App Store policy, stuff like that's different.
And I guess you can always like, there's a way to run the wallet without the GUI too, right? Like you can run a command line, is that correct?
Yeah, most of these have command line. So you can get that, I think, off the GitHub. Just go command line if you want to get really hardcore. Go full cypherpunk on us.
Zephyrpunk.
Yeah, Zephyrpunks. That would be kind of cool, except that the punks thing got used up during the Ethereum run last time. Everybody created a punk. Galactic punks and fucking Luna punks, and like every single like ecosystem had their version of the punks. Remember that? Crazy.
They milked it.
A lot of punks probably and everything.
Man, you know, someone told me about the punks. Someone told me about them. Literally, like, they were 0.01 ETH, and ETH was $80 or something, like, or $50 or something like that. Like, and I just did an ape. I was like, that's cool. And then they mooned them, dude. They mooned
them. Oh, yeah. They mooned big time, yeah. So, well, what happens is that, like, how many different things do you hear about around here? A lot. If you bought into everything, you'd have no money left. So there is an element of like, you do tend to fade stuff that doesn't seem to vibe with you. Otherwise, you end up buying everything.
And the thing was, I was like a law student at the time, but I was an Ethereum scholar. That's how I heard about it. It's like I was at the Ethereum conference. They like Ethereum scholars like this like sponsorship program.
So you have no. In other words, you have no excuse. You got wrecked.
Literally zero excuse, man.
You had all the alpha, and you just said, "Fuck it, I'm not going to listen."
Well, what I did was I went on BitMEX and Deribit, and I started slamming leverage instead, dude. Yeah, and I was like,
it was a few punks.
Dude, my issue was that my first like three leverage trades were just like massive success, and it was just me chasing pumps, but they just kept pumping, so it didn't matter. And
that's
so
no good.
Base is always free, dude. And I was like, oh, I just turned one ETH into 10 ETH in 30 minutes. Like, this shit's easy, bro. Like, I'm dropping out. Like, fuck it, I'll just run.
No, leverage is a drug, man. Like, the best thing that can happen to you is you lose money the first time. Like, big. And then you're like, oh, shit, I probably shouldn't mess with this again.
It got me good, bro. And I was like, okay, well, I mean, I got to bet more now. I mean, imagine how fast I can get it now. And then that first liquidation email, that shit hit me like a ton of bricks, dude. Like, I like almost fell over. Like, how is this possible?
Did you lose a lot?
Because it was that, this is all happening like 2019 when Bitcoin finally started to break out of that accumulation. Yeah. It dumped from 6K down to 3K and then it just went sideways for months. Well, that first little pump, that's the one I caught, bro. That's the one I caught. The first pump hour, it went from like 3K to like 6K, like overnight. I caught that one on like massive leverage, like 40X or something. And I was just like, it was like whoosh, like I was just like railed with like euphoria, you know? So, yeah.
That was right.
Yeah, I started God candling. And then like I got liquidated like on the basically like the first major like retracement, got liquidated. And I was like, I'm only 10X. Like, you know, this is safe, you know? And so I had like worked it up to like a pretty big amount for me at the time, you know? You know, it was like 80K or something. And I had started with like literally like $80, dude.
I should stop having these spaces. I should have let Zephyr like drip down to 15. Like, I don't know, like, it's just going to go up. I had this money set aside to buy more. And it just keeps going up now. Oh, shit. Oh, well, it's fine. But I like
paradox.
Because it doesn't take very long in a bull market, right? Like, people are going to be hopping on YouTube, and all those videos over the last few months, people are going to notice them. They're going to notice the ticker and shit and whatever else. And it's just going to, like, it does not take long when you are the nascent chain, when you have, like, maybe, you know, 10 or 20 or 30,000 buyers. And then that jumps to, like, 100,000 buyers. Like, price moves up really quick at that point.
Oh, yeah. I'm like, I will not be surprised at all if it just starts ripping hard. I mean, I also would be surprised if it went to 15 or something. I'd be like, okay, cool.
Yep, exactly. Cool. This is the right mindset.
Like, I might even, like, nibble, like, a little bit. Like, I wouldn't, I don't need, like, I have a pretty good size bag. But, you know, if it went down below, like, really below, like, 20 or so, like, I'd probably just send in a little bit more. Just grab a little bit, you know, pick up some. So, you know, that's how they get you, though. It probably doesn't, you know, might not do that. Hopefully, you know, maybe it does. Who knows? But it might not do that just because I think everybody would want to nibble something like that. So, yeah, the game theory of it.
When I got into Luna, it was like it had a run up to like $25 from like nothing. I mean, it was like pennies or some shit or a dollar, and it hits 25, and I'm like, ooh, what's this? And it was literally the price meme effect. I didn't know what the fuck it was until I saw the price go up. And I'm like, okay. And you start getting into the rabbit hole and digging in and this and that. So it had a DPEG event. It was the stablecoin system. So there was a DPEG event. Like, UST went from like $1.93. And then, like, you know, capital got, you know, run around, and, you know, the PEG was maintained via some arbitrage and through the PEG mechanism or whatever. And but during that time, like the panic, a couple of things happened. One is people on Anchor Protocol were borrowing off their Luna to buy more Luna. And so when the sort of DPEG event caused a little bit of panic, people started selling Luna. And when that started happening, it started causing a cascade of liquidation, even within the ecosystem, not just like external leverage. And then during that time also, you couldn't even get on because the fucking blockchain was just so congested. It's like you're trying to manage your LTV position on your loan and you can't get on because the stupid, you know, like you got delays and whatever. So then I learned, okay, I'm not going to use much leverage on this chain because, like, fuck, if you're trying to manage your loan to value ratio, you're trying to cover basically by adding more collateral. You just can't do it in a timely manner. You can get liquidated. So, so I got into like $5, and of course the thing moons to like 125 or something at the peak. I don't remember what it was. But like I bought a lot of Luna at that $5 level. And so, like, yeah, the sheer magnitude of my bag was ginormous, essentially. And at $5 Luna, it wasn't even at the size of Zeph. It was already like 10 times that or something. I don't remember what the number was, but it wasn't an extraordinarily like small market cap by that point. So, like, I think Zephyr has all that potential, but we're getting in much earlier. So we don't need to see, you know, we don't need to see like crazy upside market cap. Like, we don't have to go to 40 million market cap or whatever. We're fine if we get to one, honestly, right? That's what's nice about this. It's early and it's a strong project, and I don't need to worry about like like when I have to pull out of the thing or whatever. It's much simpler to me, thesis wise.
Yeah, like I heard about Luna first when it was like maybe like $12 or 10, something like that. And I was like looking at it, and my buddy had like sent me some. He's like, make a wallet, dude. I'm telling you, make a wallet. And he sent me like, you know, a couple $100 worth or whatever. And then I watched it go all the way up and all the way back down. I never sold any of it. It went like, you know, up to like, I don't know, I remember how much, but it was like it was a 4-figure amount for a while. And then like, I think I checked it and it was like $1,200 at one point or something, but I didn't really check it. I don't know if I checked at the peak or not, but anyways, then I watched it go back down to, I checked it after and it was like down to zero, but I wasn't really going to dump a bag that my buddy had given me really. Like, it was more about just him wanting me to learn the ecosystem. But when I got that bag at that price, I was like, looking, I was like, should I eat more into this? And I told him right then, I was like, this has a flywheel effect that if that DPEGs were fucked. And he was like, yeah, but it's just never going to DPEG because it's core infrastructure. And I was like, well, I don't know, man. Like, and so I never aped it again.
Right. Well, the idea was it was going to be like UST is going to be so widely held that, like, you know, people are going to want it essentially. And the miscalculation was thinking that that threshold had been reached, but it clearly was not. And like any attempt to sort of do something about it was like that LFG Foundation thing where they're trying to create a Bitcoin reserve member. And yeah, that had its flaws. But that's what's interesting to me about Zephyr, though, because like the BTC that they're using to collateralize with, the problem was that's not the same chain. So there's no way to sort of like do that in an automated fashion. You still have to have like central organization managing that. Whereas with the with Zephyr, you have on-chain collateral, which is proof of work, which I think is like a much better system in that respect. Because at least you know that like you can't death spiral to zero and the core collateral has some value, even if it drops by a lot. You know, as long as you're over collateralized, you should be fine. Where you should get a bit nervous would be like, okay, let's say you're constantly running at like 400% collateralization rate because people are mining the stablecoin out the wazoo for some reason. Then you'd have to kind of be like, get a little bit nervous. But I think at these levels where you're like 2000% over collateralized, honestly, who really gives a shit? Like, you're not going to have any kind of death spiral situation.
Well, the thing is that like Doquan was kind of like, I think he is where he flew too close to the sun, in my opinion. But, you know, everybody makes mistakes. And I don't think he had, I don't know, I don't really understand the situation fully. But, you know, what was happening was, you know, you're getting that Bitcoin collateral. But the threat is that if we need to support the peg, we're going to dump this shit on your head top. And, you know, it's like kind of like holding the Bitcoin whales hostage. You know, if he keeps doing this Ponzi and he keeps whipping up more liquidity, then pretty soon he's got a sizable amount of supply control on Bitcoin, and he's gonna threaten us with it if we don't stabilize his Ponzi coin. And so it's like, you know, really like, what are we really doing? You know, like what's really going on? You know, if you have to get that liquidity and as leverage against people to try to make them support your project, then, you know, maybe there's a bigger issue. So. Yeah, but you know, once it started collapsing and it depegged, like I had buddies hit me up that were Luna whales. They're like, dude, like what do I do? And I was like, listen, man, whatever it was is what was, and what is what is, and what is it's about to fucking go to zero, dude. So like you need to get out.
Part of what happened was is that so a few things happened near the top. Like one was there was something called Project Dawn, and that was where like 3 million Luna out of the I don't remember, some gargantuan number of Luna that the TFL had, they started using some of it to sort of like convert that Luna at a fairly high rate too. Like, I think like 3 million Luna a month or some crazy number. And that was like being paid out to like devs and things like that who've been like helping out with the project. And, you know, they're basically like, you know, cashing out at the top type of thing to some extent, right? That's the whole reason you have a team pool anyways to sell some, right? So it wasn't even a gigantic amount of that they were selling compared to the total number of coins that they had. But that sends a signal to the market, like, you know, to people like Galaxy Digital or whatever. It's like, oh, it's time to start taking profits if they're taking profits, right? That was one thing. And so, like, that added to the amount of Luna, you know, out in the market. You know how it is with these market caps. They're not real, right? Like, you know what, 10% of the actual liquidity is there or something, like 90% of it's just for show. So yeah. When they started selling some, that added some supply. And then with the LFG thing, I don't remember what they did. They either converted UST and bought Bitcoin or they used Luna and bought Bitcoin. Either way, you're basically taking a high liquidity coin like BTC and you've traded in for like a low liquidity thing that, you know, in the form of Luna. So I think what happened there was you also increased the amount of supply of Luna or UST in the market when you did this. Even though you had this like peg stabilization concept going, it was sort of like too little too late to some extent. But you're right, like you're using Ponzinomics to buy a coin that, well, to be fair, Bitcoin is part Ponzinomics too in a way, in the sense that it's like the new buyer is how the price goes up. But at the same time, like it's substantially more liquid than Luna specifically. And then on top of that, like that Luna, so the LFG Foundation concept, there was another thing that happened where like, some major big investors were bringing in billions of dollars
to like, you know, do OTC purchases of a BTC, and they would buy, you know, they would lock their Luna up for a number of years. I don't remember how many years it was. But the idea was like, people who believe in the ecosystem, they would like trade in their BTC to like, you know, sort this ecosystem problem out. And so all of this kind of came together. And then, of course, like there was a Curve pool migration. We're on Curve on Ethereum. There was a pile of UST there, and they were going from like, I think, Curve pool 3 to Curve pool 4 or something, with a much bigger liquidity and some bullshit. I don't know the nuances of it, because I don't know exactly how Curve works entirely. So I don't want to like make up shit, but basically they were moving some UST from one pool to the other. And this was an announced thing that was going to happen. And during this announced thing, like, I don't know what it is, but like it was going to affect the liquidity of UST or some other thing. And during that time, like right after that is when this started, or during that is when this DPEG thing happened. And fundamentally what appears to have happened is Sam Bankman-Fried, in the form of Alameda and FTX, did a couple of things. One is he opened the ability to short like UST and Luna kind of simultaneously, with him essentially dumping and depegging the Luna UST, like depegging the system. And when you create like shorting pressure on Luna while you like, by, you know, offering the ability to short this thing on top of the fact that you're simultaneously manipulating these pool migration, you basically, he crashed the system. So this is clearly like Sam Bankman-Fried slash it's mostly him for the most part, but whatever the hell, like between Alameda and FTX. And what exchanges should have been doing was, if they offered the stablecoin on their platform, like UST or Luna ecosystem, what they should have done is guarantee that they would like remit one-to-one UST for an actual dollar if someone wanted it, or for Tether. And they should have done that for every exchange that offered the thing. If they did that, you wouldn't have this problem so easily, because you could remit one-to-one. You wouldn't have like a, you know, DPEG death spiral. But then again, why would exchanges want to take that risk when TFL owns half the Luna? Right? Like, why the hell would anyone take that risk? So I don't know. The whole thing, like the things that made me nervous the entire time I was in that ecosystem were like, one of them. Yeah. So those are some of them. And then a couple other ones were, of course, like Anchor Protocol was offering really, really high yield of UST. And that yield was being paid out by Terraform Labs using their Luna, converting it to UST at market rate, and then paying out the yield on the system. It's kind of like promotional yield, and they were starting to drop their interest rate. It went from 20 to 19 to like 18 or so at the DPEG. And the interest rate was going to drop until it reached a sustainable like market level based on a balance of borrowers and lenders. And that would have gone down to like 3 or 4% yield, which means what? Slowly UST would leave that ecosystem, and again, you'd have DPEG concerns. There was another product that they had called Mirror Protocol, which is separate. Like Anchor was a lending, borrowing, yield-bearing thing for UST. The second thing that was out there was called Mirror Protocol. Mirror was this thing where you could trade synthetic stocks. The trouble with that platform is the entire thing ran on the Mirror token as the inflationary reward. So like you'd hold, like you'd do an LP for Apple stock versus UST, and you'd be getting like Ponzi-nomic 200% yield or whatever. And the number looks cool, but obviously it's, you know, emission rewards from the Mirror token. And there's no way that platform would have survived. Like, and it would have bled away, because how can you use your primary token as the primary liquidity? I mean, the primary like coin of that LPs for these funny little synthetic stocks and stuff. So that was not going to last. I knew that. And the Anchor Protocol yield part was not going to last. Everyone knew that. And then like when and if there was some kind of DPEG was going to be based on like how effective that LFG thing was going to be. And also just, you know, hopefully you get lucky and the ecosystem gets adopted widely. So that was kind of in a nutshell, kind of the issues around Luna at that time before it crashed. And then it's like, boom, everything crashes and the shit hits the fan. And simultaneously, of course, the internet was, you know, GCR was taking bets with Do Kwon and like whatever the, you know, Algod Trading was doing the same thing. And people were taking these, you know, bets like we'll bet $1 million or $10 million. And I think what GCR is like, I'll bet $1 million also. And Do Kwon says, why don't we make it 10? And so they, you know, they're just fucking around. So you have to have that bravado, though. People say, well, why is Do behaving like this? Why is he getting this quote unquote arrogant? If you're not arrogant, it sends a signal of weakness. And when it comes to a currency system, like the strength, the projecting strength is the only way to kind of like, you know, prevent the FUDders from winning, so to speak. So if he would have sat quiet, it probably would have crashed too. But then they made it sound like, oh, he was being arrogant and whatever else. Yeah, whatever. Like, you know, so were the people that were betting against the system by putting actual bets out on Twitter that the thing was going to fail, right? So, the internet just basically took this to the next gen degen level, and the whole thing got fucked over by Sam Bankman-Fried. Whoopee. So, and in the Sam Bankman-Fried trial, nothing about his depegging of the system actually got brought up, even though, like, we know that's who did it, which is pretty interesting. I guess they had enough shit on Sam that they're like, fuck it. They already threw the book at him and gave him 100 years or whatever. It's like, we don't need to prove anything else. But that was that story. But yeah, the Zeph system really does not have this issue because it neither is algorithmic nor is, and it's very overcollateralized. The worst that can happen really is no one's going to use the ZSC token, or there's not enough demand for it, or there's like just not, you know, people don't feel comfortable minting it unless it's very over-collateralized, which is fine. I think it's good. That makes it useful for us as traders, because think about it. Like, let's say, you know, Zephyr goes to $1,000 fairly quickly and you want to exit to the stable dollar in your wallet. If the collateralization ratio is really high, that's exactly when you can swap to your ZSD, which is cool, because if it's really, really in demand, and it's all over the place, then you might not be able to swap to it when you want to. If you use it as a convenience feature, it's useful for people within the ecosystem to use it, as opposed to it, the stable dollar being something circulating out in the wild very heavily. So I think it's okay if it's not over minted. On the other hand, if people do mint it for some reason, exchange listings or pairings or whatever, then the plus side of having it listed would be is that that's taking supply that requires locked ZSD, and that reduces theoretical selling pressure at the top as well. So I think this is acceptable. I think it's not scalable from a perspective of stablecoin, but I think it's enough stablecoin to be convenient for the average trader, which I think is enough reason to have it. So that's kind of my check on, like, when you compare Luna UST and this, like, why this is not the same thing as far as death spirals and shit. Because we went through all that shit. We've seen it, right? So it's not like we lived it. We were there the entire time. I was talking to Do Kwon or whoever on they almost offered him. That's why I said it. They offered me a sort of position or interviewed me for one. I was like, no, I'm not moving to Singapore. And I'm not fucking like, I don't think I can be the spokesperson on YouTube or whatever for your fucking thing. But I'll be willing to kind of like, you know, help host spaces if you want to talk about stuff. But so I'm glad I didn't, you know, stop my career and go move to fucking Singapore about this.
That's really cool that happened. I mean, even if you didn't take the offer, you know, it's kind of cool.
Yeah. I thought it was fun having the conversation. I was like, oh, you know, it truly is kind of a community chain. I guess some people said, oh, like, he likes to talk about the ecosystem. Maybe see if he wants to be like some kind of Michael Saylor for the fucking thing. I'm like, like, you know, and I just basically said no. I pretty much said no within the conversation. I was like, I didn't know what they wanted first. Like, they're like, oh, we kind of want, you know, the spokesman of the thing on YouTube or whatever. And it's like, oh, well. Number one, I'm not interested in being not anon on the internet for this type of shit. That's one. And Do Kwon being in prison right now is a perfect reason why, you know, you want to stay anon with this type of shit. Like, it's not useful to you to be well known. And the second one was, I don't want to affect my existing career. And third was, I'm not going to move to Singapore. So that's neither here nor there. So I've got family, where I'm at. Why would I want to go to Singapore for? So numerous reasons why that shit simply would not work. But anyway, it seemed like a fun thing.
Yeah, no, I think it's probably the right move, but still cool to be offered. But yeah, definitely the smart move.
Well, when you hang around this space, you get some stories, don't you? Like, we all have our like weird battle stories and strange, you know, clusterfucks, I guess. Pretty interesting. I don't go to conferences and stuff either. Do you go to all that stuff or no?
I do sometimes, yeah.
What did you go to?
Also, don't do anything that is a little bit regulatorily sketchy. Like, I just like kind of stay away from that. But so, you know, my twin brother's doxed. So, yeah, I got going for me. But I go to, I went to Mainnet. Mainnet was just so VC heavy. I didn't really like it. I prefer the ones that have the like degen types. Or like OG others, you know, like just or people that are just, you know, cypherpunky or just into the space, like, and not directly tied to some type of VC or not being funded by some VC. But, you know, you go to some of these in Mainnet, you just, it's like, oh, you're in business development too. Okay. Oh, hey. Oh, business development. All right, cool. You're a VC. Okay. Gotcha. And it's just like, okay, well, none of you guys even, I mean, let's be honest, none of y'all have any idea what the hell. You just don't know what's going on. Like, at all.
Their vibe is different entirely, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, well, like, where did y'all even, like, what are y'all even doing? Like, it doesn't make any sense what you're talking about. Like, you're going to invest, it's all these buzzwords, and it's like, you know, investing liquidity in high growth Web3 projects to bring on the future of finance, the future of interaction, the future of identity on the blockchain. And it's like, okay, well, I like all that, but, like, you just told me that your coin is another DEX, and it's like, how many of these do we have? Like, you know what I mean? It's just like, it's just a bunch of VCs that don't know about crypto. They're like, well, I want some crypto exposure. And, you know, that's just how the money works into the market sometimes. And, you know, inherently nothing wrong with that at all. But as far as going to a conference, I'm not a biz dev. And I don't really feel like investing in some random VC project right now, like, that I don't know you anywhere else. And I just got pitched on it. Like, I don't really know what your exit strategy is going to be, you know. But as far as going to like Ethereum conferences, I love those. Like, I've always had a really good time with those. And I'd say the VC ratio is much lower. You know, you go to one of those and it's like, okay, you know, 20%, 30% of y'all are like a VC or a biz dev. And then there's just like developers, which I would rather prefer.
Like, what was some of the best alpha you picked up at some of those ETH conferences?
Well, I mean, I got that, dude. I got that freaking punk entry, dude, that I didn't take. I mean, that's one of them. That was at 0.01 ETH. And what did it rip to? And that's when ETH was freaking, you know, 80 under 100 bucks for sure. It was like $80 or something like that. And then it ripped, just ripped something stupid.
Is that the most memorable thing that you remember?
Well, you know, Uniswap. I mean, but that, you know, ended up getting the airdrop or whatever, and I got a really sizable one. But, you know, back when like I was getting Uniswap V1, which I was keyed into, but it really just ended up being like I got plugged into the eco and became more aware of like how much potential this really like has. And so I like started to do a lot more of my own research and like really kind of went all in after the conference. Like, the main takeaway that I got from the conference and the main benefit that I really got was just going all in on crypto as a space right before the bull market. And so a bunch of opportunities ended up coming from that. And I don't trace any of them directly back, at least not any that I like took advantage of. But like, you know, I was hearing about all the big projects like as they were launching. I just didn't have much liquidity at the time. Like, you know, I had like $1,000 to play with or something. You know, I was a broke law student and, you know, still was like wondering if I even wanted to finish that because I saw how automation was coming from the legal market too. It's like, well, you know, when it comes down to it, crypto is a form of automation. You know, you're taking out a bunch of middlemen, especially with like, you know, with something like Zeph, even, you know, I think that it's that internal ability to swap back and forth, doesn't fully remove, but partially removes the middleman that centralized exchanges are. And so, you know, in most tech and crypto, you know, really the whole point of it is to remove some middlemen and, you know, self-custodying that self-custodying itself removes a ton of middlemen. And so I, you know, it made more sense for me to go into something that was, you know, kind of, you know, it sort of is an accelerationist point of view, but the good thing about this type of accelerationism is that, cause you know, you are automating, but you know, the good thing about this type of acceleration is that you're automating for like kind of a good purpose, you know?
and something that is tied to like liberty and sovereignty and all that. So, you know, there's something where I saw there was a lot of growth potential, but, you know, if I would have stayed in law, you know, even if you make it big law, which big law sucks. Like, I don't know how much you know about big law, but big law is freaking, you know, you get paid 160K depending on the market going right in. And then they work you 90 hours a week and you never make partner anymore. Whereas back in the day, you used to make partner and you get revenue share. But basically nobody makes partner. A lot of big law firms announce they just don't do partner anymore. And then on top of that, you know, you're just getting automated away where ChatGPT can pass the bar. I'm sure it can do, you know, yeah, most of the language models.
The lawyers that have looked at this are like, GPT and stuff can probably at least do a substantial work of a paralegal. And that's going to increase, that's going to increase substantially with like, if you saw the recent Google release too, it's pretty impressive. So, you know, you give it 5 years and like shit, like a lot of paralegals work can be done.
It's a wrap. The only thing left is litigation in 5 years.
Yeah, it seems like it. Because like the other thing too is that hasn't happened is laws have not been put into sort of like a more pure computer form, like, you know, smart contract or via, you know, and all the law books and stuff get fed into some like law genius supercomputer that like just does law. Imagine like OpenAI, but just for law, right? Because you can imagine how that looks. It's not trained on fucking everything. It's just trained, in, more importantly, on the subset of stuff specific to what lawyers care about. Just imagine how powerful that ends up being. So, yeah, it's like some of these things are definitely going to be affect people's jobs and stuff.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Especially for lawyers, which is a lot of like quite literally it's language is the whole point. So LLMs are going to be even better at like they're going to be even better at like analyzing law versus their ability to analyze, like, say, for example, scientific papers, which have a lot more, like, it's much more complicated to compare apples to apples and whatever. But with like precedent law and stuff, I mean, like the LLM can memorize the entire fucking compendium of everything that ever happened, right? So that's a hard thing to beat.
Oh, you can't compete with that
at all. I mean, the only thing you can compete with it on is, you know, trial stuff. You know, it's, there's just, the only thing that's protecting it really is regulation.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, you know, how long is that going to matter? Because, like, usually what happens is tech changes the world and the regulations, like, warp to modify around that. It doesn't usually go the other way around. So regulatory, like, can only slow things down for a while. And then eventually it's just not possible.
Yeah. And then what happens? I guess then we're in VR. And have you ever seen Separation? I think that's what it's called. Separation, maybe? Or
Separation.
It's this movie about, or it's this show that's on Apple TV that's about, it's, I recommend it. You should watch it if you haven't. But it's about a guy that signs this paperwork. And the paperwork makes it to where they do a mental block on him so where he can't remember what his work is and what work he's doing.
Oh, okay. That sounds interesting.
And he has to take this mental block to be able to get this job. But if he gets this job, you know, it's awesome. It's
on the Apple channel, or is it on, like, it's just on Apple TV generally?
Yeah, it's just like, you have to get the Apple TV app.
You know how there's like an app?
TV or whatever. Like, I just go on the TV and you can download apps if you have a smart TV, or if you can buy the Apple TV device. Which is like a separate thing.
Yeah. No, but what I'm saying is, what channel is it on? Is it like on the Apple channel? Like, you know how there's an app, like there's like an Apple TV channel. It's like where like they had like
that shit at all. Yeah, it was produced by Apple itself. So,
okay, it's probably on. I should see it then. Sounds good.
Yeah, you should definitely see it. It's very interesting, and I don't think I will tell you much more about it, but. Long story short, you know.
Yeah, no spoiler.
Yeah, I mean, I think that anything that I would say would be in the pilot, but where jobs are going is, you know, like, or where it's all going is people at the end, they need to feel like they're doing some type of work. Like, the average person just isn't built for getting dividends. They're really not.
No, like, you're right. Correct.
Like, what are you going to do all day? Like, okay, well, I got the dividends, and okay, and I got a new TV, like, all right, got a couch. All right, sit here. You know, what's going? You know, what am I going to do now? You know, and so, you know, at the core of it, what will end up happening, I think, will be gamification of the economy. or that's what I'd like to see, and then maybe incentivized participation for, like, you know, like, for example, like, if you vote, maybe you should get paid a little bit for voting, but I haven't really decided my opinion on that. But either way, the entire economy is going to have to get completely restructured, and there's just no way around it.
Like, what are you incentivizing exactly? That's the question is going to be.
Right. I mean, we can't all even do.
There's a show on Amazon, by the way, that you'd probably like. It was, what's the name of the show? It had Chloe Moretz. Oh, Peripheral. Peripheral's pretty good.
I haven't heard that yet.
It starts out like in this little bitty, like, I don't know, like small town America type of deal. And then, like, you know, her and her brother and his friends are hanging out in the forest, you know, kind of like hillbilly territory type of thing. They're just chilling out there, fucking around. And they like to play like Call of Duty and shit together. And they like to fly a bunch of drones and shit together. Anyway, a cool little feature in the very beginning of the show is like they 3D print some of their new tech locally. So you're not going to like the store to buy your shit. You're just getting your stuff 3D printed. Like, you know, someone will have a plan. You'll print your 3D VR glasses and you get into them. Anyway, it starts out with that sort of basis in mind. And then like a lot of interesting shit happens. Really, really kind of like... Well, there's no point in spoiling. It's very good, though. Chloe Moretz, of course, a good actor and everything too, actress. So she's fun to watch.
Interesting. I'll check that out. It's called Separate. What was it called?
Yeah, Peripheral. Like peripheral. As in, like, a peripheral on your computer kind of thing. Yeah, it's a good show. Okay. It's another little series. I think they finished one season or something.
A lot of these shows got striked, so that's what happened with that one I was telling you about. It got striked. Oh,
the writer strike and shit, or what? Like the.
Yeah, so like they're not even like it sucks. Like, because I watched this season, and then of course you know they ended on a cliffhanger, you know, and so I'm like, well, what's gonna happen next? But now they're like, oh, 2024, and I watched, and it came out in 2021, maybe. So yeah, but it's really well produced. I'm trying to remember the main actor's name, but I can't remember his name. But anyways, he did really well, and it's a good show. The competition is so crazy from all these outlets now, like all of the, like, you know, Netflixes and Amazon videos and Apple TV, like the competition is so high that like some of the production is just like insanely high.
Oh yeah. Like, especially the Apple stuff, they're pouring some serious money, man. Like, I really liked, I thought Foundation was produced really well. That lead actor, the guy that plays the Emperor in, or he plays Empire in Foundation. That guy was just badass. It's really cool. I mean, he did an amazing job playing an emperor. Like one of the better renditions I've ever seen of such a thing. So that, I thought that was really good. You see that one yet? Foundation on Apple?
I haven't seen that one either. I need to catch up. The last one I watched was Hijack, I think.
Okay. Yeah. It's all right. So some of the thing about like, a lot of these shows though, like a lot of these channels, obviously they go a little bit too woke, woke in the sense that like, you have the usual stuff where like they try to portray every sexual orientation in the universe on these shows. That's kind of like a thing lately, but also just like weird, like interesting kind of like. They just mix up all the random racial roles, and sometimes they don't make sense entirely. I mean, they might make sense like, well, just represent everybody. I get it. But like, it seems very forced. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, it's like, it doesn't feel natural the way they portray it. And so that what I mean by woke. And so a lot of those shows can be like that, but it's when they can produce a decent show, despite doing all that, it's pretty good. But like, there's another one that was like, what's that one on Apple that it's like, I forget the name of it now, but there's like aliens show up and, you know, families are running around helter skelter. Forget the name of that one. It's not bad either. It's pretty well done.
And then there's so many that are like really well done, but like the storyline kind of sucks. Like, have you seen that Jason Momoa one? It's called C.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I got bored after a while. I saw a few episodes. I was like, this has a potential to be pretty good, but it's like I don't know how long I can watch blind people run around forever. Like, it just kind of seems...
Dense. Made no sense. Like, if you're blind, you're sprinting through the forest with a knife in your hand, bro. Like
what are you doing?
Like, what are y'all talking about, dude?
their hearing senses have gotten amazing, didn't you know?
But it's like, come on, you know? It's like, I can only justify so much. And they got this baby that can't see, and then these people across the country, none of them can see, but the baby is supposedly can see, and they found out about it. So they have to run all the way across the country, ask people about a baby that no one's ever seen, that apparently can see, and there's no way to verify that that baby can even see. And then they got to find the baby, kill the baby. Like, what? Like, who came up with this? Like, you just wanted something with Jason Momoa.
Human beings need to be blind so you have, like, a Luddite society forever. I guess that's the theme, right? Like, at the end of the day, that's what it was. Like, technology ruined the world, and, like, everything went to shit in order to, like, you know, like something happened and everyone went blind and, like, now we're pure again. It's kind of the idea.
That was definitely the idea, but it was just like, okay. I mean, I don't know.
Jason Momoa is like the strangest pick in Dune, though. Did you see this, the new Dune movie? Like, that's not the Duncan Idaho archetype. That's, again, like, it's like the strange sort of like, why are you picking this character, this guy to do this? Like, that's Aquaman. It's like,
right. Want a cat? Like, Jason Momoa does well with, you know, people of this age group, so let's just get him in there.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. Well, there's only so many, like, giant actors, right? There's, like, The Rock, and then there's him, and there's, like, I don't know, a few others. You got to have, like, both, like, the gigantic muscle-building sort of vibe, and you have to have, like, just like an elite warrior type of look of some kind. And then you also have to have the looks and then maybe the acting talent. And by the time you whittle it down, there's just not many guys that are available for that shit. That's why you see those same actors over and over again, like Vin Diesel and whatever, right? Although I've always liked Vin Diesel. I thought he's like, he's Vin Diesel in every movie, but like, whatever.
I've always kind of liked Vin Diesel too. I like The Rock fine too, but that dude's getting a little gassed up, bro. Like, he's saying he's going to be president. Like, it's like, dude, I mean, come on. You know, like,
he's getting gassed up. Yeah, it's true. that Hawaii Oprah thing was very funny. He got into this big scandal because they were getting donations for Hawaii. You remember that? And people were like, what the fuck? You guys, between the two of you have a gargantuan fuck ton of money. Why don't you just fix the town? Like, what's wrong with you two? Yeah, but that's a common theme, though. A lot of, you know, a lot of, like, the left-wing crowd is very, like, they're very socialist when it comes to everybody else's money. But when it comes to their own money, they're, like, tight as fuck, right? Like, they don't do anything for anybody. That's a pretty common thing. Like, Oprah did her shit where she gave away shit on her show. Remember that? Like, here's the Christmas gifts, and we're doing giveaways. But most of that stuff is not her own money. It's going to be, like, sponsors and shit, right? But, like, these people get really, like, stingy when it comes to actually doing anything useful.
Yeah, dude.
No, 100%. It's all a show. Like, it's, like, you know, and also
it's virtue signaling kind of thing, you know?
Well, they're basically holders of the largest shitcoin in the world. They're like, you know, what percent, you know, like 0.25% or 0.1% of USD holders, you know, you can't dump your shitcoin. So yeah, it depends on, I guess, where they're, you know, how they think about it, but none of them end up making, you know, you make all that money and then you just stick with it. It's like, it doesn't even matter where you came from. Like, it's a little crazy to me. Like, I mean, even giving, like, those people giving, like Oprah giving 1 million is like literally basically nothing. Like, it's like the same as me going and buying somebody like a hot meal. You know what I'm saying? Like, when you're at that level of it's absurd. And then, you know, obviously you talk about, like, you know, old money, like Rothschild type, or, you know, Soros type money. And it's just like, that million's nothing, dude. It's like, literally wipe your ass with it at that point. So, and a lot of it's liquid too. So,
and yeah, I mean, but at the same time, you could say that, like, who knows? They might have. I'm not saying anything particularly negative about those two. It's possible they did tons of charity work. I have no idea. Like, who knows?
I'm just, no, I'm
bullshit. But yeah,
but you know, still, you know.
Yeah, right. Still, it is. Who knows? Like, they could have handled a lot of the Hawaii problem themselves, quite honestly.
That's what I was thinking about too. Like, you know, Oprah's had a very nice house there, so yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then people had it rough, dude. People had it, and they still do have it very rough. So,
yeah. Oh, by the way, I need to go, and I've got to go do some errands. I got to get in the car, so I'm gonna jump. It's been fun hanging around. I think next week next week I have to go back to work. I've been on holiday for the last 2 weeks, just dick around at home. So just chilling on Twitter Spaces.
Mining some shitcoin, right?
Mining a shitcoin and, yeah, having a good time.
Who's going to take over hosting these during the day?
Oh, I don't know. We'll see. Hopefully I'll be able to get on a fair amount. It depends on how the work schedule looks.
Yeah, let's hope not so many people do stupid shit before the holidays, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what I'll do without you guys in my head while I drop around.
Yeah, I'm going to be working like 3 weeks straight, so it's like weekends, weekdays, nonstop, all the way through like the 31st of the month. So I was off these last 2 weeks, and I'm going to be working 3 straight weeks. So I've got a long, like, when I'm working, I'm working. When these 2 weeks, I just kind of like, I had off because I thought I was going to travel these 2 weeks, but then I ended up not, and then so I'm sitting around at home on my ass doing nothing. Where like, so I'm like just chilling with you guys and stuff. figure out how to do mining rigs and other BS. So we'll see how it goes. All right, guys, we'll have a good time.
Gotta run.
Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of trash is under the dirt. We rape and plunder the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play. Ring around the rosy while the thunder is served. Motherfuckers walking around here looking faceless, trying to make a living selling friendship bracelets. Dead ends dragging out the max amount of payments. Red down days got them acting all bankless. Yo fam, what? Check these tokenomics. They probing this bear, flexing broken honest. I had to lay my soul down, I'm just roasting otters. And then to end a long day, 11 bowls of chronic. Never known the politic, I was born to frolic. It's been my policy to pollinate all over the plot. We got a lot of apologists jumping in at the top. We like to measure their velocity before they hit rock bottom. Over impossible loss, it's all moss, and I'm liking the odds. Fondue in the morning, forming mycological bonds. Flick the cap, yo, the road is highly involved. Flip a coin, diary falls. Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of trash is under the dirt. We rape and plunder the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play. Ring around the rosy while the thunder is served. Trying to figure out the max amount of dinner lay stacked in non-toxic, just to get a better place. Smacking on the hostage like this shit is play for keeps. Clowns, white knight, and all these Maybellines. They call it implausible when model after model keeps on ripping off the coat and going full throttle. Eats, tearing apart your community. All these low-hanging fruits bearing zero liquidity. Got a planet in reach, coming standard to each. I'm on the back 10, stargazing after the siege. Commanding all the management to grab a few seats, and then we'll round up the beasts and send a messenger east. Y'all better sign a release when I'm bumping these beats. Hands up if I got motherfuckers drumming the streets. Yo, we got a few dubs, we got a couple defeats, and if you're coming for the king, you better have some of each. Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of treasures under the dirt. We rape and plunder the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play. Ring around the rosy while the thunder is served. Channel Spaces.